Okay. One more. Right. Let's begin.
Om Sahana Vavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Sahavidyan Karavavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarva Guhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarva Vide Namaha.
Very good. Nice to see you all. And welcome also to the many students who attend these classes regularly online. We continue with our study of chapter 16 of Shankara's Great Upadesha Sahasri. We just finished a portion in which he discussed the teachings of several schools of Buddhism, mostly Shunyavada, Vijnanavada, and he deconstructed them and ended up dismissing them, of course. And we also shortened our discussion. We said that starting with this chapter, we're taking an abbreviated version, leaving some of the highly technical verses out so that we can proceed in a nicer manner. His refutation of the Buddhists is over, and now we're back to more familiar territory. If some of you felt a little bit out of the familiar territory while you were discussing Buddhism, not surprising. So, and as I said in those classes, we just barely touched the tip of the iceberg. The level of detail when Shankara and other great Vedantins discuss other schools of thought, discuss them, compare them to Vedanta, and go through a very detailed process of analysis. The level of scholarship will break your head, breaks my head. Anyway, I've some of the advanced texts. I start reading, there's one, Sankshepa Sharirika. I've started to study it at least three times. So far I've only gotten in maybe 20% into the text. I get it, get into it, and then I just, anyway, you get the idea. Yes, very, very detailed analysis. Okay, we continue today, however, with some much more. Oops, what did I just do here? That's why. Okay, too many buttons here. Okay, there we go. Okay, so we pick up the thread, and you'll find yourself back in more familiar grounds. In fact, Shankara returns to one of his favorite topics, and that is that your true self, the consciousness that's present right now in this ordinary experience, that consciousness is utterly unchanging. He's talked about this so many times, and he comes right back to it. The fact that he comes back to it again and again should make it very clear. It's an extremely important teaching. Otherwise, he wouldn't come back to it again and again. So, let's pick up the thread. Tata vikriya rupatvan Tata vikriya rupatvan Navastantaramatmanaha Avastantaravatvehi Twehi Nashosyasya Nasamshaya Nashosyasya Nasamshaya. Very good. Start in the second line. Atmanaha, for Atma, the true self, na avastantaram. There is no other state, other, antara, no other avastha, state. For Atma, there is no other state. Atma has no states. We've discussed this a number of times, but I see a few of you are coming for the first time. How many books have you read that talks about three states of Atma or four states of Atma? Whoever wrote those books didn't study Shankara. Certainly they didn't study Upadesha Sahasri, because how obvious is it here? Na avastantaram atmanaha. Atma has no other states. You're saying, but what about waking, dream, and sleep? Fine, three states of the mind. Absolutely, we can call them states of experience, we can call them states of mind. They are not states of Atma. Atma has no states. And you think, what about Turiya, the fourth? Those of you who have properly studied the Mandukya Upanishad, where that term comes from, you'll know that it's not a state. It's Atma itself. It is the unchanging consciousness that reveals the three states of the mind. I'll say that one more time. Turiya is fourth. Fourth in addition to the three. Fourth meaning unchanging consciousness that reveals the activities of your mind in a waking state, that reveals the activities of your mind in a dream state, and that reveals the absence of activity in deep sleep, a dreamless sleep. That's called the fourth. It is Atma. It is not a state. In fact, we have a whole sequence of verses here which is going to make this point extremely clear. If you have any doubts after these verses, you will have no doubts. Atma has no states, which means, what is higher state of consciousness? What is a lower state of consciousness? Shankara just said, na avastantaram. There is no higher state of consciousness. There is no lower state of consciousness. There is just consciousness. There's certainly higher states of mind. There's certainly lower states of mind. Drink some alcohol, you'll find out what that's like. So, fine. States of mind, not states of consciousness. And then he tells you why. In the first line, tata, because in this way, avikriya rupa twat. Twat becomes twan due to grammar rules. Because of the fact that Atma is avikriya rupa. The rupa, the nature of Atma, is to be avikriya, unchanging. This is his favorite topic and his favorite word. So, how can an unchanging consciousness have different states? It's a contradiction in terms, and frankly, I'm shocked by how many people don't pay attention when they see words like states of consciousness, which is such a common expression nowadays. Now, when Shankara says that Atma, the nature of Atma is to be avikriya, unchanging. How do we know? Is that a dogma that we just have to accept? Well, Shankara says it must be so. Oh, but then you say, no, it's traced back to the Upanishads. The ancient rishis said it, so it must be so. Well, again and again, we come back to the fact that in Advaita Vedanta, the test of truth is threefold. Shruti, Yukti, Anubhava. How do we know it's true? If it meets all three of these criteria. Shruti, is it revealed in scripture? Yes. In fact, not just in Upanishads, even in Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says, na karomi iti, I don't do anything at all. So that avikriyatva, the unchangingness, if that's a word, of Atma, is definitely first revealed by scripture. Then yukti, is it reasonable? Well, I'll just give you my stale old example, and that is if you're driving in a car and on a highway and the fellow in the car in the next lane is drinking coffee, do you experience him drinking coffee at 60 miles an hour? He looks stationary to you because you're moving at the same rate. In order to see him drink coffee at 60 miles an hour, you have to be a stationary observer on the side of the road. And this is a metaphor I've used many, many times to make the point that in order to observe this flow of thoughts, what do they call it? A chain of consciousness? It's not even consciousness, it's thoughts. Anyway, in order to observe, you're constantly changing mental activities. Everything you pick up with your five senses, all of your thoughts, all of your emotions, whatever is happening in your mind, in order to observe that constantly changing flow of mental activities, you necessarily must be an unchanging observer. You are the unchanging observer of the constantly changing activities of your mind that's supported by yukti, reasoning. So here, revealed by scripture, supported by reasoning. Then, what about experience? Because experience here doesn't necessarily support being unchanging. When sadness enters your mind, you feel like you became sad. You, the conscious being. You, the conscious observer of sadness. The sadness seems to rub off on you. That's a very common experience. Of course, we've given this, this is not our topic, but the quick example is sadness seems to rub off on unchanging consciousness, just like the orangeness of this cloth seems to be present in the crystal. Seems is the key word here. So how do we know that for sure? And the answer is in meditation. In fact, meditation is a little bit like taking this crystal. Yeah, this looks orange. If I take this crystal, suppose the only time you've seen this crystal is right now, and you're not sure, is it? Swamiji says it's not orange, but it looks orange. What shall I trust? Shall I trust what Swamiji says, or shall I trust what my eyes see? Well, suppose we conduct a brief experiment. Now what? Now you'll know that the orangeness is an appearance and not a reality, and what Swamiji says happens to be true. It's not an orange crystal. This, by the way, is a metaphor for meditation. It's so simple when you really think about it. When you become quiet in meditation, when all the changing activities of your mind go away, do you find yourself moving or still? In fact, we call it stillness. You don't have to be a master meditator to get there. You have to meditate, absolutely. You have to learn meditation properly and practice it every day. But you don't have to be a great yogi to enjoy a few moments of stillness, silence. And in that way, anubhava, experience, also supports the truth that your consciousness is unchanging. Avikriya, unchanging, revealed in scripture, supported by reasoning, and confirmed by your experience in meditation. This is how we know it's true, and it absolutely removes any possible argument that this is some kind of Vedantic dogma. Vedanta has no dogmas. Vedanta is all this process of inquiry. Okay, second half. And he gives some further reasoning. He says in the third line, he, because of the stantravatve, he says, if it were true that Atma assumes different states, that is, Atma is one state when you wake up, Atma is in a different state when you dream, Atma is in a different state yet in dreamless sleep. If that were true, then Shankara says, na samshayaha, without doubt, nashaha asya syat. That Atma would be subject to destruction. And what he means by that is, if Atma exists in one state, in the waking state, and then in the dream state, the waking state Atma goes away, and a dream state Atma comes into existence. Change implies destruction. Here's 1 minute of pure logic that you really need to understand. In any process of change, destruction is implied, because for A to change to B, A ceases to exist. In any process of change, the prior state of existence gets destroyed before the succeeding state of existence can exist. Anything subject to change is perishable, to use a common word. And we certainly know that it's kind of a common experience in our lives. Our bodies are constantly changing. And we know eventually that these constant changes are going to culminate in the death of this body. It's just common sense. Anything subject to change will perish, because change implies destruction. Okay. So Atma is unchanging. Now we move on to a related topic, but not quite the same. So if Atma doesn't have any states, then isn't moksha a state? Does Atma undergo any change when you gain moksha? That's what the next verse addresses. Moksho vastantaram yasya, moksho vastantaram yasya, krataka sachalo hyataha, krataka sachalo hyataha, na samyogo na viyogo va, na samyogo viyogo va, moksho yukta kathanchana, moksho yukta kathanchana. Yasya, for Atma, If Atma has avastha antara, same word used in the prior verse, if Atma has a different state, and that different state is moksha. So if moksha is a state or condition of Atma, then that state is kritakaha. And this introduces a topic that is so fundamental in Vedanta, we need to spend a few minutes to understand. Kritika means an effect. That which is the result of an action. Is moksha the result of an action? Attending a class is an action. Studying scriptures is an action. Self-inquiry is an action. Meditation is an action. Karma yoga, obviously, is an action. Everything, meditation is an action. You gotta sit down and quote, and you deal with your mind. They're all actions. So it's only natural to ask, is moksha the result of an action? The actions, not ordinary actions, but the actions that we collectively call sadhana. So sadhana, spiritual practice. Do the actions of spiritual practice result in enlightenment, moksha? So here, I need to go to the board because there's one really important principle that I can only show you by writing out. And that is a Vedantic analysis of action. What can action produce? Kritika, in our verse, means the result of an action. And our typical Vedantic, this is an important Vedantic analysis. It comes in a lot of, maybe not in the text so much, but in the commentaries, this analysis will come. There are four effects of an action. That is, action can produce something in four different ways. Number one is, and I'll remind you, I only put Sanskrit terms up on the board where they're important. I promise you I will never put an unimportant Sanskrit word on the board, but it's important to build a vocabulary of the really important terms that we use. Utpadya is that which is produced. That which is produced like a pot. You start with clay, and you take the clay and you produce a pot. A pot is a newly produced object. So upadya, the second, let me get them in the right order, apya. Another effect of an action is to gain something. For example, you go to the store and buy something. Or a better example is when you reach a destination. So this morning you got in your car, you drove here. This being here is a result of your act of driving. So it's another kind of effect of an action. Very different than producing a pot, right? So a pot is one kind of effect of an action. Arriving at a destination is a very different kind of effect of an action. Another one, therefore, is vikarya, is a modification. Okay, is this right on the board? Good. So some kind of modification. When you when you start with milk and you make yogurt, you've made yogurt. Yogurt wasn't there before. Yogurt is a modification of the milk. Please note that's different here. When clay becomes a pot, clay is still clay. When milk becomes yogurt, what happened to the milk? It's gone. So don't confuse these two. So when clay becomes a pot, the pot is produced. When milk is transformed, that's the sense of this word. Milk is transformed. Clay isn't transformed. Clay remains clay inside the pot. This is a process of transformation. This is the third kind of change. And the fourth kind of a change, not change, effect of change. Samskarya. We'll say purified is not the right term. How about cleansed? So after eating your dinner, you've got dirty dishes. So how do you turn a dirty dish into a clean dish? Through the activity called dishwashing, which probably is done by a machine in most of your homes, which is good. But it is the result of an action, and that's our discussion here. So actions can have, thank you. I keep forgetting, and that's important. Thank you. Okay, let's get back here. Boy, I'm spacey today. Here we go. Okay, thank you. This analysis, you may think it looks very philosophical, but now in the next three verses, Shankara is going to apply this to Atma. If Atma, if you act upon Atma and produce a result of an action called moksha, then which one is it? Is moksha created like a pot? Is moksha reached, emerged with Brahman? Is Atma transformed? Vikarya, is Atma cleansed? And each of these sound like, maybe. Maybe so. And you can probably see that there, you could probably find some way to analyze moksha in terms of one of these four and support. But here's the problem. The result of an action is proportional to the effort, right? For a small effort, you get a small, regardless of the action, but there's a degree of effort. For a small degree of effort, you get a small result. For a larger degree of effort, you get a larger result. For a huge effort, you get a huge result. Moksha is which of those? Beyond, right? You say off the charts, so to speak. That's a nice expression. Moksha cannot be the result of a finite effort, because moksha is an infinite result. Consider, you know, any effort made would result in some kind of finite result, a result that may last for some time. So, for example, in deep meditation, you reach a state of absolute bliss, let us say. How long will that state remain? Depends on your effort. More effort means more bliss and longer bliss. How much effort would it take to remain permanently in a state of bliss? Permanently in a state of bliss. Presumably, that would require an infinitely long effort. Because as soon as the effort stops, the bliss starts going away. Make sense? You've had that experience in meditation. While you're meditating, the bliss is there. When you stop meditating, what happens to that bliss? It goes. So if you want permanent bliss, how long should you meditate? Well, that's not a very reasonable solution. Anyway, the point here then is anything, let's go back to the verse here. He says, anything that is kritaka, anything that is the result of an action, the result of an effort, if moksha is the result of an action or the result of an effort, then he says, saha chalaha, hi ataha, that therefore would be saha, that moksha would be chalaha, temporary. If moksha is the result of a finite effort, that moksha would be temporary, like the bliss in meditation. You put a lot of effort into it, that bliss goes away. Make a connection here for you right now. So, which Shankara says anything that's a, should make that connection? We'll try. If moksha is the result of a finite effort, that result, that moksha, will be chalaha hi. It's indeed transient, temporary. Into which of these four categories would you put this transient moksha? Moksha, which is the result of an effort. Could go in several categories. And by the way, there's no one right answer to this question. I would tend to put it in the category of vikarya. It's a modification. Just as it's a modification of your mind to create a condition of bliss. Bliss is a modification of the condition of your mind. That modified condition is temporary because it's the result of a finite effort. So if moksha is the result of some effort to transform your limited mind, to transform consciousness into that which... I'm smiling now because I've just realized I've omitted a very obvious statement. And that is, this conclusion will come at the end of three verses, but let me give away the, what do they call that? Punchline. Not punchline. It's the, if you're watching a spoiler. That's the word. Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. So, exactly the right word. So here's a spoiler. It comes in about three verses. And that is, Atma is already enlightened. Atma is moksha by nature. That's where we're going. And that's the so-called spoiler. So the point here then, if the nature, and if, because it'll be established in these three verses, so let's take it as a hypothesis right now. As a hypothesis, hypothetically speaking, if Atma really is moksha by nature, mukta, if it's liberated by nature, then any transformation you make of Atma is going to make it better or worse. If it's already perfect, and then you go around messing with it, is it going to get better or worse? Okay, this is our first, we're going to go through all four of these right now. So he starts with this vikarya. If you, any change to consciousness is not going to be an improvement. It'll be the opposite of an improvement. By the way, why isn't deprovement a word? It should be. If there's improvement, then there should be deprovement. It doesn't exist in our English language, that's okay. And the reason I say that is Sanskrit does that all the time. You can use these prefixes very freely, but not so in English. Okay, second half. Two more examples. He says, in the last line, moksha na yuktaha, it is not reasonable that moksha could take place katanchana in any way if that moksha were the result of samyoga. Samyoga is when two things are combined. So two things are combined. You've seen the expression, and I gave the expression before, merging into Brahman. Well, that's a good example of number two, right? You attain something, you reach something, you reach Brahman. You've read that in a number of books also. You merge with Brahman, you reach Brahman, you attain Brahman. That's not what Shankara says here at all. He says, na samyoga. It's nothing you reach, it's nothing you attain, because if you get there, you can leave. If you merge with Brahman, you can separate. What is the rule? If you merge, you're going to stay permanently merged. Where is the rule? Logic says otherwise. That which comes, goes. that which goes up, falls down. This is common sense logic. So You can merge with Brahman. Meditate. It's not a big deal. So you merge with Brahman in meditation, and then what? Your meditation comes to an end. This is the limitation of anything that's kritika, the result of any effort or action. So again, finite effort and action can lead you to merge with Brahman in meditation. But that finite effort produces a finite result, a limited result. If you merge with Brahman, you'll enjoy it for a while, then it's over. In fact, the next word has to be taken in a little different case. Vyoga is the opposite of samyoga. Samyoga, coming together. Vyoga is separation. And separation here is separation of atma from your body, mind, and senses. Generally, they're like this, all interwoven, which is why when sadness arises in your mind, it seems to affect you. Proximity. Notice it's proximity that makes this crystal appear orange. It's proximity between consciousness and your mind that makes you feel sad when sadness enters your mind. So then what is the solution? Let's create some distance between atma and mind. Not a little, lots of distance. Because if there's a little distance, you can have a little bit of a problem. So if you have lots of distance, then you have no problem at all. Except the same logic applies. Just as two things that come together go apart, two things that are apart can come together. Finite effort, finite result. Mahabharata gives this lovely metaphor of two sticks in the river. Many of you have heard this. These two sticks in the river, they bump into each other and they flow together for a while. Then they separate. That's how life works. That which comes goes. That which starts stops. Everything. Finite effort, finite result. So this is the fourth category, samskarya. If you want to cleanse atma of the body and mind, scrape it off like you're scraping your dishes. You scrape the body and mind away so pure atma remains. The problem is, actually, that's a good metaphor. You put your dishes in the dishwasher and they're clean. How long do they stay clean? Until you use them again. We have to clean them again and again. And the idea here is if you do this separation, atma, separate from mind and body, they naturally come back together. They separate them again, come back together again. And it's an ongoing cycle. Point is, finite effort, finite result. Then he gives another common example in the next verse. Actually, the sentence continues. The last half of this verse, the sentence continues in the beginning of the next verse. Samyogasyapyanityatvad, sanyogasyapyanityatvad, viyogasyatatayvacha, viyogasyatatayvacha, gamana gamane chaiva, gamana gamane chaiva, sarupam tunahiyate, sarupam tunahiyate. And he just gives some basis for the prior. He said that moksha cannot, na yuktaha cannot, in prior verse, moksha na yuktaha cannot reasonably, katanchana, in any way, moksha cannot be samyoga or viyoga. Why? He says, samyogasya api anityatvat. Because combination of things, samyoga, merging with Brahman, Shankara says plainly, anityatvat, it's temporary. any kind of merging, reaching, attainment is temporary. A good example is gaining wealth. It's temporary. We know it's temporary because when you die, you can't take it with you. So even if you're pretty good at accumulating wealth during this lifetime, you still lose it. So there's no way to keep it. Anything gained through effort is finite. The result will be finite. You can't take it with you. So samyogasya anityatvat. Anything that you gain or attain or reach is temporary. Viyogasya tathaivacha. And the same is true for viyoga. Whatever you clean gets dirty. Why do we take a shower every day? Because our bodies pick up dirt every day. So whatever you clean gets dirty again and again. Finite effort, finite result. How long should you stay in the shower if you want your body to remain permanently clean? What kind of logic is that? So taking a bath, a shower, is a finite effort. It necessarily creates a finite result. And he applies this also to gamana and agamana, coming and going. And this is actually a reference to going to heaven. Excuse me. By the way, many Hindus who don't follow Advaita Vedanta believe that going to heaven is moksha. That's a very common connection for many. And the ancient rishis criticized that view very strongly by saying, if you go to heaven based on your finite accumulation of good karmas, will a finite accumulation of good karmas leave you in a heavenly state for infinite time? Again, violation of basic reasoning, common sense. Your finite worldly actions to do good deeds, to do lots of rituals in the ancient worldview. Can you do an infinite, if you want to go to heaven for an infinite time, how many rituals should you perform? There's a logic. It would take an infinite number of rituals to accumulate enough good karma to take you to heaven for an infinite amount of time. Therefore, if you go to heaven, it's temporary. If you come back, it's temporary. Any result of any action is temporary. That's the point here. And now he gives what we're really talking about here. The point of all of this argument so far is in the last line. Surupam tu. But surupam, the very essence of Atma, na hiyate, can never be lost. The nature of Atma can never be lost. For example, we use these three words, Satchidananda, to describe Atma. So the nature of Atma cannot change. As we've said, avikriya, Atma is Satchidananda in an unchangeable manner, which means Atma is always Sat, Atma always exists. That's what Sat means here. Existence. Atma existed before your conception. Atma will certainly exist after your body is burnt. So Atma is independent of the body and mind. It is a fundamental reality. It always exists. Sat. Chit. Consciousness. Atma is always awareful. Atma is always conscious. And that even applies before your conception, after death, and it even applies in the state of deep sleep. We've had this discussion many times. In deep sleep, you are as conscious as you are right now. But there's nothing to be conscious of. The metaphor I've given too many times is standing in a dark closet with your eyes wide open. What do you see? In a dark closet with your eyes wide open, you see nothing. Do you see nothing because you're blind? Hey, you can still see, right? You still possess the power of sight in a dark closet. It's just there's nothing to be seen. Same way in deep sleep. You are conscious. There's nothing to be conscious of. Finally, ananda. Ananda here does not mean an experience of bliss. Experiences come and go, so we cannot translate ananda as a condition of bliss. It is better understood as perfection, limitlessness, vastness, boundarylessness, pure contentment, pure peace. These kinds of words. That doesn't come and go. Your mind can be peaceful or disturbed, but the consciousness that reveals your mind being peaceful or disturbed, that consciousness is unchanging. The unchanging consciousness that reveals everything happening in your mind. The very nature... Let's make a connection here. Let's see where we're going here. All right. Let's see the next verse, because it'll make it easier for me to make this point. The point that I'm not satisfied with yet is that the very nature of Atma is unchanging, therefore it's already liberated. Take it as a hypothesis right now. Let's look at the next verse and see if we haven't established that very clearly through the next verse.
Sarupasya nimittatvat. Sarupasya nimittatvat. Sanimit. Ta hi cha pare, sa nimitta hi cha pare, anupatam sorupam hi, anupatam sorupam hi, svena tyaktam tathaiva cha, svena tyaktam tathaiva cha.
Start in the third line. Swarupam, the essence of Atma, Satchidananda, which is unchanging, he says, very importantly, anupatam. It is not something produced. In fact, upatam is related to that first word, upadya. They come from the same root, produced. So he is saying here, Atma is not produced, and we need to illustrate that. Let's get back here. Atma is not produced. Anupatam surupami. So the example we gave for something produced was the pot. The pot is produced. Now state, this is a metaphor. In this metaphor, clay is not produced. Clay is already there from the already existent. I know that clay doesn't naturally exist, but this is a metaphor. Stay with the metaphor. Don't. If you argue with the metaphor, then it's not useful. So in this metaphor, clay is the pre-existent reality out of which this pot is produced. Is Atma the product of any other pre-existent reality? Now, if it were, that would mean Atma has a birthday. There was a date when this pot was produced. Before that date, clay existed, but the pot did not exist. There will be a date when this pot ceases to exist. One day I'll drop it. not on purpose, but it'll probably happen at one point. So which means that this pot will have a date on which it dies. That which is produced has a birth date and a death date. Atma has a... There was a date on which it was produced. And from what other reality? Atma itself is a fundamental reality. Fundamental means it's not produced, like the clay in this metaphor. So, na utpata, anutpatam sarupam. The nature, Atma itself, Atma by its very nature, is not a product, that is not produced, doesn't have a birthday. Tathaivacha in the last line, and also svena atyaktam. It cannot lose its nature. This pot can lose its existence. Clay cannot lose its existence. Your body can cease to exist. Consciousness cannot cease to exist. Your mind can cease to exist, as it does in deep sleep, in dreamless sleep. Your mind is fundamentally non-existent. Consciousness continues to exist. So this is the fourth. We skipped over the first one. Shankara went through each. Let me put that back up on the board. Now, Shankara went through each of these four in these three verses to show how Atma, to show that moksha cannot be the result of an action, because all actions, all efforts are finite, and moksha is limitless, timeless, boundless. Now we need to make the final conclusion here. He says, and he gives the basis here, sarupasya animitatvat, because the essence of Atma, sarupa, the essence of Atma is animita, it is not produced. Atma being Satchitananda is not produced. It is an eternal reality. And he gives a counterexample. Sanimita hicha apare. Anything else can be produced. The pot is produced, the table, the chair, this body was produced. So everything else is a product. Atma is not a product. Now the one dangling point that I skipped over, I really have to make this point, we'll make this the final part of the class. Then, given the fact that I think the translator has made a mistake. Who is the translator? The one sitting in this chair. It says, sarupasya animitatvat. You see that Atma in parentheses? Not Atma in parentheses. It's moksha in parentheses. So we've got a mistake here. So this is all about not... Even in the prior verse, translator made the same mistake. Twice! There's Atma in parentheses again. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. The topic is not Atma. What is our topic? Moksha! So what is Shankara saying here? In the prior verse, he says, moksha cannot be destroyed. That which is created can be destroyed. That which begins comes to an end. Like this class. Class has a beginning. Class will very shortly have an end. Anything that begins has an end. If moksha has a beginning, it has an end. If it has an end, it's not moksha. Our definition of moksha is an ultimate state of liberation. An ultimate state of liberation is not something that's going to end one day. So therefore, moksha cannot have an end. Now here's the final logic. Moksha cannot have an end. That would make it finite. If moksha has no end, it couldn't have had a beginning. Anything that begins has an end. Moksha can't end. Otherwise it wouldn't be moksha. Moksha has no end. Moksha has no beginning. If it has no beginning or end, then what is its relationship to Atma? Swarupa. That's the word Shankara has used in three of these verses. The very nature of Atma is moksha. Now that sounds very abstract, so let me put it in real simple common terms. How many times have you heard that your true nature is divine? That's a very common Hindu teaching. Your true nature is divine. When did it become divine? Yesterday? Day before? So if your true nature became divine at some point in time, it means someday in the future, you'll stop being divine. As well, you'll be some kind of rakshasa, some kind of demon. And it's all silliness. So to say that your true nature is divine is a very simple, common way of Shankara's statement that Atma is nitya mukta. His exact words. Atma is eternally liberated. Just as you don't have to... Let's go back to the chart. Your true nature is divine. Which button? This one. Your true nature is divine. If it's already divine, do you need to produce it? Number one. Upadya. It's already divine. You don't need to produce anything. If it's already divine, you have to apya. Do you have to gain that divine nature? That doesn't make sense. Do you have to vikadya? Transform your nature? It's already divine. Do you have to samskadya? Make it more pure? It's already divine. How do you improve on that which is already divine? So here we're using this very common language to show that your true nature is by nature. Your true by nature, not good English. Your swarupa, essence, there we go. Your essence is divine. Didn't become divine and won't stop being divine. Because divinity is its essence. In Shankara's language, Atma is nitya mukta, eternally liberated by nature. Doesn't have to become liberated, doesn't have to reach anything, doesn't have to get rid of anything. Atma, by its essence, is already perfect, full, complete. I've made the comment many times that the Mahavakyas are all in the present tense. They never said you will become that. They said you already are that. Leading to the final question of today's class. That is, if Atma is already liberated, what are we trying to do here? Well, here's the issue. How well do you know your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, which is eternally liberated? If your inner divinity is not fully known to you, if it is covered by that so-called veil of ignorance, then you're walking around as a divine being without knowing your own divinity. That's what Vedanta is about. We are all, some author made this point, we are all divine beings playing the role of limited human beings. But we forgot that it's a role. Like we're actors, but we've forgotten that we're acting. We haven't forgotten, we don't know who we truly are. So the purpose of these teachings is not to reach something, gain something, transform something. The purpose of these teachings is to remove that so-called veil of ignorance, to reveal that inner divinity, which has always been divine, which always will be divine. This is absolutely unique to these teachings of Advaita Vedanta. They call it praptasya praptihi. You gain what you already are. That's what Vedanta is. It's like, you know, the metaphor, the story you've heard, you know, the lady is lost her necklace, and she's looking in every room of the house, she's looking outside, looking everywhere for her necklace. It's been there all the time. That divinity has been there all the time. It's up to us to recognize it, and the purpose of his teachings is to help you recognize that. Okay, a good place to stop for today.
Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma hamritangamaya. Om shanti 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 hi. Om tat sat.
Very nice. Okay, off.